From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack, alongside host Evan Dawson.
Hello, Megan.
Hello. Weekend Connections is a fast-moving podcast that offers a sample of what we talked about on the show this week. And we begin with an important question for voters. If your candidate does not win the presidential nomination, would you vote for the candidate that does?
Oh, we're finding that Clinton voters tend to say yes, they would vote for Bernie Sanders. But Bernie Sanders voters are not nearly as ready to say they would immediately vote for Hillary Clinton or anyone else. So here's the debate between Mary Lupien, a delegate for Bernie Sanders locally, and Josh Keaton, a local Democratic activist supporting Clinton. We begin with Mary's response to my question. If Sanders is not the nominee, are you ready to vote for Hillary Clinton?
We talked about this before the program, and I said no. And I will preface that by a lot of people are trying to change my mind about this, but this election for me is not Republican, Democrat, Bernie, Hillary. This is for or against corporate control of government, and I think my vote for Hillary would be a vote for corporate control of government, and I think the people are tired of that.
All right, here comes the hammer of pragmatism, Josh Keaton, to weigh in on what happens if you decide I wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton. What's your concern with Sanders supporters, Josh, who say, I love Bernie and I don't think I could vote for Hillary?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. If you look at the way that our political discussions are happening right now, a lot of, just nationally, you hear a lot of folks saying, well, look at how radical the Republican conversation is and look at how myopic perhaps conservatives have been when they've been in Congress and they've been legislating and they've been doing things around the country. But I think it's important to recognize that if you look at the state of play right now politically, you have overwhelming amount of Republican officials throughout this country, whether it's at state legislatures, whether it's in Congress, certainly the Senate. The only thing that's really preventing rolling back the progress that we've seen the last 8 years is a Democrat in the White House.
Mary Lupien, I just want to follow up on Josh's comment and ask you another question here. Mm-hmm. I understand your feeling seems to be that Hillary is too much of the machine.
And, that's right.
And that is what is kind of keeping it, you know, you away from being able to even support her if she beats Bernie Sanders. But let me ask you about Supreme Court appointments. That is a big part of what the next mm-hmm. president will have. You know, it could be one and it could be four appointments, but we're talking about the impact on legislation. And if you look at the last 2 years alone, you could look at same-sex marriage. I mean, I could pick out half a dozen issues, right? We could talk about money in politics. We could talk mm-hmm. about so many others. Would that possibly motivate you to change your mind?
Well, that is one of the arguments that has been used to get me to change my mind.
Is it a good one?
It is a good one. It is. A very good friend of mine, her cousin is a quantum physicist in Texas, and he deplored me, please change your mind. He sent me many emails using that same argument, and I can see it. And I'm not so rigid that I don't take things into consideration, so we'll see. But right now, I mean, the most important thing for me is getting money out of politics. I work with people in poverty, and I have a lot of experience, and I'm sick of watching people get poorer and poorer, and the richer get even more rich. So for me, I have to vote with my heart. And I think a lot of the way politics is, you know, with this not wanting to waste your vote is why we have a lot of what we have. And I'm not willing to not vote with my conscience right now.
Now let's hear from Republican voters. Same question. Our panelists Anna Garvey and Josh Veronica are supporting Marco Rubio. So we asked if they would support a different Republican if Rubio is not the nominee.
I would not vote for Donald Trump. I absolutely would not.
Would you simply not vote, or would you vote for Hillary Clinton? Would you vote for Bernie Sanders?
I don't think I could vote for Bernie Sanders.
Would you vote for a Libertarian candidate?
I probably would end up voting third party Libertarian or just simply not voting at all. And I don't think I'm alone in that as far as other Republicans that I know that just could not see themselves getting behind Donald Trump. We just find him to be hateful and not has no respect for the Constitution. You know, a true conservative wouldn't really be able to get behind Donald Trump. So other than that, I think I could see myself supporting most of them out in the field, but definitely not Trump.
Josh Veronica, is there any candidate?
Just Donald Trump. I think everyone else in the Republican field would be a good candidate. Obviously, I think Marco Rubio is the best, but, you know, even John Kasich, Jeb Bush, I think they'd all be great presidents. But Donald Trump is the one where I would really be afraid for our national security if he was the president.
Let's turn to an issue that has become a hot topic in the Finger Lakes, the Seneca white deer.
Kind of an amazing story, and it's one that some people will say, oh, I've lived here my whole life and I've never heard of this. So a little background here. 1941, the United States Army built a depot between Seneca and Cayuga Lakes. It's nearly 10,000 acres, fenced off. You'll see it if you drive along the east side of Seneca Lake. And for the next six decades, The Army stored munitions there, heavy weaponry, bombs, about 500 different bunkers they call igloos, made of concrete and steel. And in the year 2000, the Army said they were done with the site as a munitions dump, or a storage site, and the Army Corps of Engineers would conduct an environmental cleanup. That cleanup is now done, and the site is up for bid.
And it's what you'll often see just inside the fence that has so many people worried.
Worried about the animals there. We're talking about the white deer. The largest herd of white deer in the world are inside the depot site. And not albino, that's a common question. They're all white, white-tailed deer. They just happen to be trapped inside the fence, and so they were protected from hunters and predators when that whole thing was founded back in 1941. You will see white deer down there now. They're beautiful. But the concern is that the winning bidder for the site will take the fence down, develop the land, and leave the white deer to be hunted out of existence.
We welcome Dennis Money, the man behind SenecaWhiteDeer.org, who has been organizing support to build a new ecotourism park there. He explained what he wants to do with the land, if he's the winning bidder, and how the white deer were saved in the 1950s.
Occasionally, a white fawn will be born to a brown doe and a brown buck. It's unusual. And that's exactly what happened in the depot in the 1940s, late 40s, because the population had increased so much that the chances of a white deer being expressed as, you know, being born as a white fawn, it happened. And those were the two white fawns that were born. And that's when Lieutenant Colonel Kemble ordered his troops to not shoot the white deer. If anybody touches those white deer, you're on the next plane to Greenland.
If you win this bid, it's not just about making sure the white deer are saved, which is, of course, an aim here, but it's also about creating ecotourism, opportunity for the public to do what? What's the vision?
Ecotourism is a fantastically huge business around the world. And I think we have a unique opportunity here at the depot because we have the magnets, we have the white deer. And you use those white deer to attract people to come to Seneca County. And once they get inside the depot, they will not only see wildlife, they will also learn about the military and the civilian history of the depot. And we found from our evaluations, from our past touring experiences, that the deer are used, as I said, to attract the people to come. But after they've been through the tour, which lasts from 90 minutes to 120 minutes, they come away feeling that the military and civilian history are of equal weight and importance to seeing the white deer. But also, it's the jobs that are generated outside the depot, because these people are going to come from all over the world. They're going to spend money in wineries. They're going to spend money in hotels, restaurants, gas stations. So you're going to have this overflow effect that's going to benefit the entire county and the Finger Lakes region in general.
Next up, we welcomed tennis icon and equality advocate Billie Jean King. She's coming to Rochester on February 10th to headline the Susan B. Anthony Luncheon. In 1973, she beat Bobby Riggs in the so-called Battle of the Sexes match.
She whooped him badly. It was a huge victory on the court, but also for female athletics.
King reminded us that Title IX had just passed a year earlier, and she felt pressure going into that match to validate women's rising place in sports. And in this clip, you'll hear her talking about how people have reacted over the years to her victory, starting with President Obama.
Well, the first time I got a one-on-one in the White House with him, of course, you can imagine, I was like, ugh. I couldn't even sit in the chair next to where you usually sit for the photos. I sit over on the sofa, and he looked at me like, huh? But he did explain to me, in fact, he said it did influence him because he was 12 years old when he watched the match. I think he was born in 61. And I find that many men that come up to me were at that age, 12 to about 18. And it's very impressionable age. And they're the ones that cry more than the women when they come up to me. They get tears in their eyes because now they have a child or children. And they always say, I think I know I'm raising my daughter differently because of that match. And I want her to have as much as my son. And I think, you know what, bingo. And then the women, on the other hand, come up and they say it really gave them confidence, self-esteem, empowered them. They asked for a raise for the first time. And I said, more importantly, did you get it? And they said, yes, we did. You know, I did. And that's when I know the different genders, what they got out of it is very interesting and their perceptions. But I find that the men come up to me and they said that it changed their whole life and how they thought about women and how they should be treated, about equal pay, and all these things, and how slow it's been. They can't believe it's still not happening, because when I played Bobby, white women were making 59 cents on the dollar, and now we're up to about 88, and the women of color still are making way, way less. It's got to stop.
Now to the debate over a new study on home births.
Yeah, not many women in this country deliver their children at home, but that number is growing. In Holland, it's 20%. In the UK, 8% of births are at home. But for decades in this country, it was less than 1%. Now, it's up to 1.3%. That's a 50% increase in the last 10 years, driven mostly by women who say they want to have a comfortable, controlled birth experience at home.
The new study analyzed deliveries in Oregon and found that delivering at home leads to fewer C-sections and less medical intervention.
But, according to the study, it also doubled the rate of infant death from 1.8 per thousand in the hospital to 3.9 per thousand at home. So first, let's listen to Dr. Lorelei Thornburg, an OBGYN who focuses on high-risk births.
What we're talking about with this study is helping women to see the data and to understand what's the right choice for them and what's not the right choice for them, and for making informed, educated decisions about those choices. So not just saying, well, I want a home birth, but understanding, is that the right choice for my risk tolerance, for my risk category, for what I want for the outcomes for myself and my child? Are those compatible with a home birth model? And so for me, it doesn't change where I'm going to deliver my patients, but it does add a piece of information that I think has been missing, because a lot of the push on home birth as a safe choice has been driven by the European data. And to compare the European data to the American data, where the Europeans have a very thoughtful, cohesive care plan for what happens when home birth is not go according to plan or when their interventions are needed, and a population that engages in medical care from a very young age in a preventative method with excellent access to education, medical care, right from a young age. I think it's very hard to compare our outcomes to their outcomes before, and this gives us a piece of information about what actually is occurring here in America.
And now here's Amy Haas, a certified childbirth educator who's been involved in many home deliveries.
What we see are very definitive ways of determining who is and who is not eligible for a home birth. So they would be being low risk, choosing and planning to have a home birth, hiring a licensed birth attendant, and the last part is putting the transport protocols from home to hospital in place. This study doesn't change my opinion. It just reiterates the fact that we have more work to do.
Let's close with the conversation that created the most laughter this week and maybe even inspired a new name for classical music.
You think? Maybe. It all started when a music journalist in Nashville named Craig Havighurst wrote a piece this month saying that the term classical music needs to be replaced. He's not the first to say so. He says the category is boring, it's not very descriptive, it's not inspiring. So Havighurst suggested replacing the word classical with composed music for a variety of reasons that you can easily find if you Google his piece.
We put together a panel to debate the proposed name, and it turns out pretty much no one liked it. We had composer Carrie Ratcliffe,
a local composer who's nominated for a Grammy this year, by the way.
Yep, along with local writer Dan Kushner and our own Brenda Tremblay from Classical 91.5. And after everyone sort of dismissed the term composed music, Brenda revealed her proposal for how to rename classical music.
So here's my idea, right? So composed music and classical music, we're kind of stuck with that. So here's my idea, right? We rename it artisan music. So people give it incredible focus, like a hand, you know, microbrewery, or, you know, they sit down at a great meal. Like, this is something to pay attention to. This is so much thought and craft and love went into the making of this music. Let's call it artisan music.
Go get it, Dan.
I like that better.
Oh, you
yeah,
do? Woo!
I do.
Oh, it's just because she's sitting here next to you.
Brenda and I have always been fairly simpatico, I think. I think that I'm going to have to chew on that a little
bit.
But I think that it's not exclusionary, and yet it does speak to the craft involved in really any particular kind of music. It's broad enough and yet specific. And it also, as you were suggesting, it taps into the idea of there's a certain interest in artisanal, in the craft of whatever the field is.
But is it too broad? Because I've got a friend who would say Eddie Van Halen is an artisan.
I don't know. No, Eddie Van Halen's a good, you know, there's no hierarchy. You know, there's right. George Eastman believed that classical music would make people better. There was a moral, hierarchical form to it. And that's ridiculous. Of course it's not. But if you love classical music, if it speaks to you, it is the most powerful and ennobling thing, I think. But I've completely lost all objectivity because I spend my mornings, you know, presenting it. And I just love it so much. But I think if we went around the table here, we would have, each of us would have a story of a piece of music that just stopped us in our tracks, yes. whatever we were doing, whether we were paying attention or not, that we felt an out-of-body love for this art form, that whatever we call it means so much to us all.
Maybe Brenda's idea will stick.
Probably not.
It's still called Classical 91.5, at least for now.
And Play the Strings, cue the Connections theme music, which is not actually classical. It's a little nice string there, a little cello and violin with pop music. Our thanks to Ra Ra Riot and Barsook Records for our music.
And our thanks to you for listening to Weekend Connections.
Yeah, you can find full podcasts of each hour of Connections at wxxinews.org/connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely weekend.
I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk to you Monday on Connections.